The Expanding Tree of Life, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Tree of Life visualizes diversity on Earth, and most of it is in the form of small single-cell organisms.
Those branches are each more different from each other than we are from worms. They're closer to the difference between us and a mushroom.
Also, from the strictly human world, new documents link Syria's President Assad to war crimes. This former U.S. diplomat says the case against Assad would be a slam dunk.
The stronger the evidence you build, the more difficult it is for the world to sweep that under the rug.
Plus, how early map makers dealt with their fear of the unknown.
There was this prevailing belief that every land animal had its ocean equivalent. So you'll see sea pigs and sea bears and sea elephants.
Map monsters and more today on The World. Great you could be here, because I could sure use some company, especially after finding out today that I am next to nothing. Just look at the Tree of Life and you'll see what I mean. Compared to everything else that's alive on planet Earth, we humans are a minuscule slice of life. Kind of gives you a new perspective on all the news out there, even, or maybe especially, tragic headlines like from the war in Syria. We'll get to Syria in just a moment, but let's stick with the Tree of Life for a few more minutes. The tree is actually how scientists classify the diversity of all life on the planet, from us humans to the lowliest bacteria. I talked about that today with microbiologist Laura Hug. She and her collaborators have just proposed a new expanded version of the Tree of Life in the journal Nature Microbiology. And yeah, our human branch is looking a bit smaller now.
30 years ago, the Tree of Life was really based on organisms that we were able to have in culture or the physical characteristics of the organisms that we could see. And now, with genome sequencing so common, we're able to look at a much wider diversity of organisms. And so the differences in the tree is that there's many more organisms on it compared to 30 years ago.
So we're talking plants, animals, humans, of course, bacteria. What are some of the things that we, you know, lay people would not have thought about that actually is alive?
Okay, so there are two different major groups of single-celled organisms. And I think most people have heard the word bacteria. And then there's also another group called the archaea, which are also single-celled organisms, but represent an entirely independent lineage of life.
I mean, what's really astonishing about the Tree of Life, not just this one where you've discovered a lot more stuff out there, but plants, animals, humans, we're just a tiny sliver of everything on Earth. Talk a bit about how the new research methods using gene sequencing and big data, how that is changing how we view this diversity.
This is really coming from advances in our ability to sequence genomes from different environments without necessarily having to have the organism in a lab. And what that's letting us do is look at a much broader range of environments, and that's leading to discoveries of hundreds and thousands of new organisms on the Tree of Life, and these are all single-celled bacteria and archaea. And in humans and eukaryotes in general, which is everything from plants and fungus and humans, do take up less of the Tree of Life.
Right, and bacteria make up most of the diversity of life on planet Earth. How much more different are all the types of bacteria from each other than, say, we humans are from, like, worms?
Right. So if we're talking about, you know, major branches on the Tree of Life within the bacteria, then those branches are each more different from each other than we are from worms. They're closer to the difference between us and a mushroom.
You know, we've been told, and I gather that it's true, that human beings and bananas share 50% of the same genetic material. So if this Tree of Life underscores that, I mean, it's a great conversation starter. But aside from that, is there an important lesson in this for us humans?
I think it's important that we understand our place within life on Earth. And I think this tree starts to underscore how much of that life we can't even see.
What do you say to people who ask you, what is our link? Why is it important to have these microbial communities?
Microbes, I think, are most famous for causing disease. But in recent years, it's become much more clear that they're actually responsible for preventing a lot of disease within humans. You have a healthy gut microbiome. You have healthy microbes on your skin that are protecting you. Organisms in the environment do most of the nutrient turnover that keeps soils healthy for agriculture. They're fixing carbon and keeping really the world running. And so they're incredibly important, even though we don't necessarily always see that very clearly.
Yeah, so what happens if we humans wittingly or unwittingly wipe out some or a lot of this diversity?
what this study was really looking at was trying to find an understanding of that diversity so that we'd have a better understanding of what we stand to lose. So I think it's a big unknown what would happen if we lose, you know, a lot of the diversity within these microbial lineages.
Microbiologist Laura Hogg telling us about the new proposed expanded version of the Tree of Life, which comes out today in the journal Nature Microbiology. Laura, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, now to Syria. 5+ years of war there have produced a lot of bloodshed and uprooted millions of people. Bashar al-Assad is still president, though, and according to his many critics, he and his regime are still committing crimes against their own people. During the war there, that's included bombing civilian areas, but also using lethal gas on civilians, not to mention torturing and executing suspected opponents. But to actually have proof of all of that, proof that stands up in court, is another matter. Now, according to a story in The New Yorker today, we have that proof. It comes from some 600,000 pages of documents obtained by an independent group of lawyers known as CIJA. That stands for the Commission for International Justice and Accountability. Ben Taub wrote the story for The New Yorker.
So the Commission for International Justice and Accountability has these 600,000 pages, and most of them they smuggled out themselves. But a few come from a mole within Assad's highest level security committee called the Central Crisis Management Cell. This was a cell composed of around a dozen high-level regime operatives who Assad had personally appointed to handle the crisis in March 2011. And they would draft proposals for each security issue and send them to Assad by courier, who would then sign these directives and return them for implementation.
So could you imagine the documents from this crisis cell that Assad set up being the smoking gun in a war crimes trial against Assad? Or would there also need to be testimony from people who were there, who were tortured, that are still alive?
There would certainly be witness testimony, but the documentary evidence is the strongest point here. The internal regime documents are always the sort of hardest evidence because, you know, people can call into account the veracity of witness statements. They can question whether witnesses have been influenced by things they've seen in the press or by living in crowded refugee areas or something like this, and that narratives converge. But the documents are signed. I mean, these are documents coming from the innermost security committee. Basically, the head of the CIJA told me that, you know, when it came time to identify suspects, they weren't really looking. They didn't think they'd be able to trace this up to Assad when they started the operation. They just thought they'd see how high they could trace it. But when it came time to identify suspects, it was very easy because the names were all over the documents.
You know, one of the most kind of fascinating aspects of this story, Ben, especially after the leak last week of the Panama Papers, which was 2.8 terabytes, you know, fit it on a few thumb drives, I guess. But this was an analog leak. I mean, transporting literally pieces of paper out of Syria. And you say at one point that one man had 1,000 pieces of paper, pages, taped to his body as he crossed the Syrian-Turkish border. This sounds like a lot of very hard work.
Yeah, that's one of the things that made it so difficult and so dangerous is these documents are heavy. I mean, the head of the CIJA was telling me, look, like, think of a box of paper next to the photocopier. That's around 2,500 pages and it weighs around 20 pounds. They've extracted 600,000 pages. So you need cars, you need to know how to get through checkpoints, you need to do reconnaissance. It's incredibly dangerous and this material is incredibly incriminating. Even if you're in, you know, opposition area, because radical Islamists, for instance, they see a guy who has 100,000 pages of Syrian regime documents on him, and they're going to think either this is a regime spy who's trying to get this material to safety, or that it's someone who's working for the CIA or something like that. The concept of international criminal justice is kind of lost on them. So there's no way to sort of explain it away. You just don't want to be caught with this stuff.
Ben Taub with The New Yorker. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on.
Stephen Rapp is the former U.S. Ambassador at Large for War Crimes. He's currently at the Hague Institute for Global Justice. I know you've had a chance to review some of these documents, Ambassador. As a war crimes prosecutor, what could you do with them?
Well, if we have a court to take them to, we could charge and prove cases against the top level of the Syrian regime for murder and torture as crimes against humanity and war crimes.
I mean, you're pretty well placed to talk about this. You worked on the case of Charles Taylor and war crimes in Sierra Leone. You're convinced that there's enough evidence here to prove beyond reasonable doubt that Assad himself personally authorized crimes against humanity?
Certainly. There's not any question. I mean, I led the prosecution of Charles Taylor, and I was earlier at the Rwanda Tribunal leading the prosecution of senior officials of the Rwandan regime in the genocide. And the kind of evidence that we have here linking the top level of this regime to these acts of mass incarceration, mass torture, mass murder of at least 10,000 civilians in Syria is far stronger in terms of that direct connection than we had in those other trials. And we generally prevailed, certainly. In the end, Charles Taylor was convicted of 11 counts of war crimes and crimes against humanity and is serving a 50-year sentence today.
Mm. From what you've seen in these documents, what was the one that really kind of you felt was a smoking gun or really swayed you?
The question is all the series of connections. And first of all, keep in mind that crimes like torture by the regime in the whole series of its detention facilities and what's happening there, those are under the control of the state. And one can attribute responsibility under international law to high-level actors if they have notice of those crimes and they fail to take action to prevent or punish. So these are almost always better cases than the ones you get where the militia are doing something or even where bombing is going on, because there can be a question about what the bombs were aimed at. Mm. These are aimed at torturing and maiming, gouging out eyes, burning with the, as we heard, burning this child with a welding torch, committing these horrendous crimes by the regime. And then what the documentation shows us is the way in which these people were ordered in, the reports that go up the chain about how it was being done, and the orders that come back down. And then we have this whole extremely rich document trail, because you've got these different parts of this maze of a state structure that are each communicating about these acts. So we've got it at both ends in the middle of the linkage. So that's why this is so impressive.
Back to that question, what court would prosecute him?
That indeed is the challenge. We've had other situations where regimes were powerful and no one ever thought their leader would come to account, and that they were needed in peace processes, or they were needed for this or that, or they had powerful protectors. But the stronger the evidence you build, the more difficult it is for the world to sweep that under the rug.
Is there a possibility that with this evidence, or perhaps a bit more evidence, arrest warrants could be issued for Bashar al-Assad?
Well, again, the question is what court that they're issued in. Obviously, if you have national courts in other countries, generally they can't charge a sitting head of state. They can charge all sorts of other people whose names are on these documents and in the briefs that the Commission on International Justice and Accountability, this NGO group that was described in the Taub article, have developed. So for a chief of state, you need a court of international character. That requires an ICC or a UN tribunal, or it would require some kind of mixed court. And so we don't have that yet. On the other hand, this kind of evidence gives notice to the world that the day of justice has to arrive. I mean, we've accomplished it in other cases, and we found a way. And given what's happened and what continues to happen, we have to work to break down that door of justice and to make it possible to have judgment in a case like this one. What we have here is very strong evidence. What we need is a recognition that this evidence that must be heard, and that we need to establish a court where it can be heard. And I think the stronger the evidence, the better the chance.
Stephen Rapp, the former U.S. Ambassador at Large for War Crimes, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Glad to talk today. Take care.
Coming up later on the show, is the U.S. running out of bombs? This is The World. It's only Monday, but I'm guessing British Prime Minister David Cameron is wishing the week was already over. The heat from the Panama Papers scandal is now bearing down on him. Turns out the Prime Minister's father had an offshore account set up legally to lower his tax burden in Britain. And David Cameron inherited some of the profits, before becoming prime minister. Again, nothing illegal here. Cameron has now disclosed his tax returns, the first British prime minister to do so, but his initial decision to dismiss any criticism over this issue has angered a lot of British voters. And over the weekend, thousands turned out to protest on his doorstep in London. The World's Bradley Campbell was there, and I take it, Bradley, some creative energies went into these protests. There was a Caribbean theme to highlight the offshore companies.
Oh, yeah, Marco, it looked like a Jimmy Buffett concert was about to start in downtown London. I mean, there were beach balls, there were Hawaiian shirts, people were in Panama hats. But pretty soon they also picked up, you know, protest placards and started chanting. And then I realized, you know, probably wasn't going to get a margarita. But anyway, I met one of the protesters in the organizer event, Abby Wilkinson, and she actually told me the reason for the whole tropical theme.
If all of these UK companies get to pretend that they're based in tropical hotspots for tax purposes, why can't we pretend we're somewhere nice and tropical as well?
Yeah, well, I don't know how the weather was, but at least they were in the mood. How many people showed up on this Saturday morning, and where were they all gathered, Bradley?
Oh, God, thousands of people were gathered all in front of 10 Downing Street, which is kind of like Britain's equivalent of the White House. It's right downtown. Big Ben's kind of in the background, right across the river from the London Eye, the big Ferris wheel. And they ended up blocking off two lanes of street there.
And why did they say they had come out?
Because they were upset, not necessarily about what they learned in the Panama Papers. What they were kind of upset about was his response to it. And one of the protesters told me it was kind of this lesson in the present tense, because David Cameron always kind of starts by saying, well, since I was prime minister, that's like the first starting point. Anything before that, it's like it didn't happen and didn't exist. One protester said to me, you know, it's kind of like he's this unfaithful boyfriend in the idea of, like, you ask him, have you cheated on me? And he says, well, I'm not cheating on you at the moment, and I don't think I'm going to cheat on you in the future.
Interesting analogy. The pictures that you posted at PRI.org really immersed me in this scene. Just based on your conversations and what you saw, did it look like the beginning of a movement? And if so, a movement to do what? Get Cameron out of 10 Downing Street and make politicians more accountable? What's the end game here?
Seems like the people there on Saturday, the protest was to try and get Prime Minister David Cameron out of 10 Downing Street. It's hard to say if they'll be able to do it. But they did say at the very end of the protest, if you think this protest is big, just wait till next week, where an even larger one is scheduled to happen.
The World's Bradley Campbell in London. Thank you.
Yeah, you bet, Marco.
You've got Follow Friday, Throwback Thursday. Let me introduce you now to Map Monster Monday. Dori Klein came up with the hashtag. It's her way of highlighting on Instagram each Monday some of the maps she works with at the Leventhal Map Center here at the Boston Public Library. Many of those maps are pretty old, and yes, they are illustrated with drawings of monsters.
So in the medieval and Renaissance period in Europe, people didn't really know what was out there. Your corpus of knowledge came from folklore and the Bible. And so in that world, monsters could very well be real, and they were part of this supernatural landscape. When a map maker didn't know what was out there, he might just plop some little creature in there to signify, I don't know what's here, but it could very well be a dangerous creature.
Are you saying that cartographers actually believe that there were sea monsters out there?
Sometimes, not always. Map monsters didn't appear in every single map. So if you were creating a map that would have actually accompanied sailors out to sea, it would have been generally much more practical information. They would have had an idea that there were probably monsters out there, and you didn't need to tell them precisely where to find them. People back in Europe, however, really wanted to get a feel for their world without leaving, because travel was very difficult at that time. So these maps became a way to understand your world while you yourself did not go exploring.
I mean, some of these fantastical monsters, where did they get the ideas for them? Because, I mean, there's some freakish-looking creatures here.
Well, if you were to go out today and ask a person to draw you a creature that lives beyond our galaxy, beyond our known world, you would get a lot of bulbous foreheads and toothy grins and spines and weird tails and extra legs. And that's because we don't know what's out there. Also, there was this prevailing belief that every land animal had its ocean equivalent. So you'll see sea pigs and sea bears and sea elephants and sea horses.
They let their imaginations run wild.
Yes, and there's a really diverse cast of monsters.
When did you discover these sea monsters and your kind of study of maps?
When I first started working at the Map Center and wanted to familiarize myself with the collection in the vault, which is our secure storage space, I would be filing a map or taking a map out, and I would see another little face. And there was just this kind of, oh, hello moment, you know, you get...
From a very scary-looking creature.
Some of them do give me the heebie-jeebies. Just yesterday, I was flipping through a 1525 edition of Ptolemy's Geographica. Mm. I saw a little man standing upright with horns, and he was cooking a woman. And oh, she had this blithely complacent expression on her face because this was a woodcut and it was very hard to convey detail. So it was horrifying and slightly amusing. It was one of those jolting reminders that all of the monsters that you see embedded in these maps really were genuinely scary in a way to the people who were looking at them.
At that time?
Yes.
Yeah, I feel kind of today some of these monsters, at least the ones I've seen, they have more in common with Hayao Miyazaki's creatures than, say, Alien.
Right, or Muppets.
Yeah, more like Muppets. When did cartographers kind of like stop drawing these monsters into maps?
They started to fade away toward the end of the 17th century as navigational technology and printing technology improved. So it was easier to convey more accurate information. So you might see pirate ships as an indication of there are dangerous pirates here, or these are good fishing waters. You'll find whales here. But it wasn't an immediate disappearance. It was more of a fading out.
So it's Monday, and you've got something called Monster Mondays. This is an online feature that you post.
Right. So it's Map Monster Monday. And maps, especially historic maps, can be really intimidating sources. I think if today you're looking at one of these maps, you're looking at a flowery typescript, possibly some Latin, and a world that looks nothing like the world we know today.
I mean, it's the Latin that scares me off.
Right.
I give up now.
Right. Totally. I wanted to connect people with our collections and make these maps a little more accessible and a little more fun. I mean, they're beautiful and fascinating, and the stories behind them can turn into just a rabbit hole of research.
In a good way.
In a wonderful way. Yeah.
Dori Klein from the Leventhal Map Center at the Boston Public Library. Thanks for telling us about Map Monster Mondays.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've got this Monday's Map Monster up on our Instagram feed. Just look for PRI's The World, if you dare. I'm Marco Werman. A German film puts a Hitler lookalike on the streets and lets Germans react.
No matter where we went, there were always people who like really kind of fell for him, basically. That's like kind of sad in a way. It was good for the film, but like sad for our country, I guess.
Look Who's Back, coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. President Obama and all the candidates vying to succeed him seem to agree on one thing. The U.S. and its allies must somehow defeat ISIS extremists. Now, the way that's being done at the moment relies heavily on airstrikes. Some estimates suggest that the Pentagon has already dropped nearly 40,000 bombs on ISIS targets in Iraq and Syria. Last December, Air Force Chief of Staff General Mark Welsh said, "We're expending munitions faster than we can replenish them." We wanted to find out if that's still the case, so we turned to someone who keeps track of the companies that make the bombs. Roman Schweitzer is a defense analyst at Guggenheim Securities in Washington. Tell us what you actually do, Roman Schweitzer, and what is your firm's association with the defense industry?
Sure. Thanks, Marco. I'm a defense analyst, cover these companies, the large defense primes, and how their programs are doing in Washington and how their companies perform in the equity markets. Guggenheim Securities actually has no direct relationship with any of these companies.
So you're pretty well positioned to tell us, is the U.S. running out of bombs?
It's really a function of supply and demand. The Pentagon tries to balance its inventories based on what it plans to be using in the future. And I think over the last 2 years, we've seen that those projections have been a bit off as it's ramped up the campaign against ISIS, not only in Iraq and Syria, but in Libya as well.
So you're saying that the campaign against ISIS has severely depleted the U.S. stock of bombs?
There are also NATO and Gulf Cooperation Council allies participating in these strikes as well. And in some cases, they're drawing off of U.S. stockpiles because their own domestic inventories may not be sufficient.
So let's dig down into some of the costs here of these bombs. I mean, these bombs are pretty sophisticated. Tell us about just one of them that's used a lot, how it's made, and how much it costs.
You know, it's actually kind of interesting because in the early days of the campaign or, really the first night into Syria, the Navy fired a bunch of Tomahawk cruise missiles. And those are in the $1 million range. But they're really sort of the higher end of what you might use if you have a contested airspace and you don't want to put aircraft over targets. But really, then you get down to the lower category, something like a Hellfire missile that's fired off of one of the Predator or Reaper UAVs, and those are in the tens of thousands of dollars, exactly. And really, you know, over the skies in Iraq and Syria, pilots are able to get close because you're not fighting a very sophisticated, albeit a brutal, enemy. And you're able to use shorter range but more precision-guided munitions. And part of that's twofold. One, you want to be precise on who you're hitting. And two, you don't want to hit other people because these are, you know, obviously some congested environments and the enemy adapts and puts himself in positions where he's hard to target without collateral damage.
And we hear that there is actually a lot of collateral damage.
I think that's one of the things that the Pentagon has spent a lot of time and attention in terms of identifying those targets in order to minimize civilian damage. But it is an unfortunate consequence that I think even under the best circumstance, some of these things can go awry.
How long does it take to build a Hellfire missile?
Well, the actual construction of the missile itself can be, you know, very quick, but it really depends on how you ramp your production line and how many workers and shifts you have. You know, in some cases, the Air Force has said it would take perhaps up to 4 years to rebuild the total inventory, but that's not the actual manufacturing of an individual unit or munition.
How busy is the order department at the Pentagon right now with some of these companies like, you know, Lockheed Martin and General Dynamics?
Lockheed Martin has said they've been asked to increase their Hellfire missile production facilities, as well Boeing, which makes the Joint Direct Attack Munition called the JDAM. They are also ramping up production. There are, you know, a few categories of munitions that are sort of preferred, and I think they are definitely busy.
So the U.S. Military uses these weapons, but the United States also sells them to other countries. Can you talk about that a bit?
Sure. I mean, these are long-standing relationships where a lot of these countries have established supply relationships and contracts, and they want to be able to be interoperable with the U.S. and use those preferred munitions. And really, that's, you know, Gulf states such as Saudi Arabia, as well as European allies such as the United Kingdom.
And what's your sense of what happens when Saudi Arabia, which is, say, bombing Yemen right now as part of a coalition, when they drop American munitions on targets and people see those weapons and they see that they're made in the U.S., what kind of effect does that have on kind of attitudes towards this country?
I would imagine it's not positive. And I think that's perhaps one of the unintended consequences of the current style of warfare, even for that matter, that the U.S. conducts in terms of drone strikes, you know, around the world. However, that is the push-pull between policy and action and inaction.
Roman Schweitzer, an aerospace and defense policy analyst for Guggenheim Securities in Washington. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
The nuclear deal with Iran, it went into effect months ago, and still Washington and Tehran bicker. President Obama has knocked Iran for failing to live up to the spirit of that agreement, and Iran complains it's not getting enough of an economic boost from the deal because of remaining U.S. sanctions. Meanwhile, Canada is taking a very different approach. The new Liberal government in Ottawa says it wants to normalize relations with Iran. The World's Matthew Bell was just in Toronto, where he spoke with some Iranian expats about that.
When the conservative-led government in Canada cut ties with Iran in 2012, leaders in Ottawa gave several reasons. They cited Iran's nuclear activities, its funding for Middle East terrorist groups, and its threats against the State of Israel. Those might sound like good reasons, but Canada's new foreign minister, Stephen Dion, describes it as a big mistake.
Canada's severing of ties with Iran had no positive consequences for anyone, not for Canadians, not for the people of Iran, not for Israel, and not for global security.
Sude Ghassemi agrees completely. She's a 32-year-old accountant born in Iran who lives and works in Toronto. More than anything, she says, closing the Canadian embassy in Tehran punished ordinary Iranian Canadians and their relatives in the Islamic Republic.
Like my grandparents, they came to Canada before once when the Canadian embassy was open in Iran, but they can't do that anymore because they can't travel to Turkey to get those paperwork done.
The Toronto area is home to about 100,000 Iranians. They've settled here in waves over the decades, going back even before the 1979 Iranian Revolution. And for them, too, the closing of the Iranian embassy in Ottawa has meant headaches. When they need to get official Iranian paperwork sorted out, the closest place they can do it is Washington, D.C. And for Iranians, getting a visa to enter the U.S. is rarely easy. But Bijan Ahmadi, a 29-year-old real estate developer, says this isn't just about convenience.
Establishing a dialogue and diplomatic relations between Iran and Canada, it does not mean that these two countries are each other's friends. At least that's not what I think will happen immediately. It just means that there is a dialogue between these two countries. Both of them can actually stand on their positions regarding different issues and still talk to each other.
That's how you get things done, Ahmadi says. It's how you promote human rights in a country with a dismal track record like Iran's. It's also good for business.
About once a month here in Toronto, there's a networking group of Iranian Canadians who get together and they have drinks and they just hang out, get to know each other. And I'm here at a pub. It's on the north side of the city, and I'm with Armand Ahmadi. He's a 34-year-old banker. You just became a Canadian citizen. You're just telling me you're very excited about business opportunities in banking between Canada and Iran.
Not only in banking, but also in every other industries, there are major opportunities for Canadian companies in Iran in terms of their investment and the knowledge. Iran has been deprived of investment for three decades now, and there is like huge potential for growth in the economy. And for
Ahmadi and others, the sky's the limit now that Western sanctions have been lifted. But not everyone is so excited. Ardashir Zarizadeh works on immigration issues in Toronto. He's an outspoken advocate for human rights inside Iran, in part because of what he went through himself.
Well, I was leading student activists back in the country for years, and I had a role in Iranian student uprising in July 1999. And I was arrested 12 times. I spent 2 years in solitary confinement. I got 7 years jail sentence, and I had to flee the country.
Having a dialogue with Iran is fine, Zarizadeh says, but don't think the government is capable of real reform. Canada needs to be aware of this, he says, and not be naive. He wants Canada, the U.S., and the rest of the international community to put more pressure on Iran to make fundamental changes in the way the government treats its people. Doing business and making nice with Iran, Zarizadeh says, could end up giving this regime a free pass. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell, Toronto.
There are differing ideas about change inside Iran as well. I saw that firsthand when I visited Tehran a couple of months ago. But I have to say, most of the young Iranians I met were excited about what could happen as relations with the West improve.
My name is Negin Nasiri. I'm 26 years old. I studied sculpture at Tehran University.
Negin Nasiri is one of those people. She's a designer in her 20s. You may remember her. She was on the show a few weeks back. Not too long ago, she was ready to leave Iran, but she had a problem. She'd been accepted to a graduate program here in the U.S., but her visa was denied. Negin's best friend, Shagayak Jahanbani, was really happy about that. She didn't want Negin to leave.
I'm glad that she didn't get the visa.
Long story short, today Shagayak and Negin are successful business partners. They design and build custom furniture in Tehran. We've got an animated video of their story. It's up on our Tumblr. That's pritheworld.tumblr.com. Here's an update on the presidential elections in Peru, which were held over the weekend. There will be a runoff in June. Last Friday, we told you about conservative frontrunner Keiko Fujimori. She got most of the votes, despite the controversy surrounding her father. He's a former president, Alberto Fujimori, now serving time in prison. The other candidate in the runoff will be Pedro Pablo Kuczynski, who came in second yesterday. Reporter Simeon Tagle in Lima told me he wasn't that surprised with the results.
Not really. I mean, the polls have been predicting this for quite a while. It is perhaps surprising, at least for someone outside of Peru, that someone with the baggage, you might say, of Keiko Fujimori and her father has been this successful. But you have to remember, Shining Path, the effect they had on Peru back
the
in the
guerrillas. Yeah.
The guerrillas back in the early 1990s, they were letting off bombs in downtown Lima. It would be a little bit like ISIS today, setting off bombs, launching terrorist attacks in New York or Washington, D.C. So for him to have presided over the defeat of Shining Path is something that many Peruvians remember and revere him for.
Yeah, and just remind us why Fujimori, Alberto Fujimori, is in jail.
He's in jail. He's been convicted of three different things. One is ordering the extrajudicial killings of terrorist suspects, some of whom it turned out not to have anything to do with Shining Path at all, and one of whom was an eight-year-old boy. He's also has been convicted of using public money to systematically bribe corrupt journalists to smear his opponents.
All right, so he's a convicted felon. What is the other baggage from the father that Keiko Fujimori continues to carry through her life and through this campaign? Anything that's a liability?
Yes, just rampant corruption. Her father's administration was, I think by most definitions, a kleptocracy. Transparency International, the anti-graft organization, has calculated that $600 million of public money disappeared on Alberto Fujimori's watch. The thing is, corruption is now so endemic in Peru that I think a lot of voters are resigned to it. They have a saying here in Spanish, roba, pero hace obras, which means he steals, but he carries out public works. Huh. And that kind of sums up the attitude that people, if a leader is effective, they'll accept that he is a little bit corrupt as well.
Also, diversity seems to be playing out in this election. You've got Kuczynski, who comes from Polish extraction, of course. Fujimori, her father, her grandparents were Japanese. This may be obvious to you, Simeon, but is this the face? Is this the diverse face of Peru in 2016?
It is to a certain extent. Peru is a multicultural, multi-ethnic nation. I think what's important also just to understand, perhaps, in understanding how Peru still has a way to go to heal the racial divide, is that Mendoza is white, so is Pedro Pablo Kuczynski. Fujimori is of Japanese extraction, but the country is predominantly people of indigenous South American extraction, I would say. And so the fact that none of them have featured that prominently in elections is also something that I think Peru, it says a lot about contemporary Peru.
So, Simeon, what happens next? As in, what kind of drama should we and Peruvians expect to see from now until the runoff in June?
Well, I think there will be a lot of drama. Keiko, despite her huge lead over Kuczynski, the two now go into this runoff vote. She has a lead of 16%. She actually is vulnerable. Polls have shown that her first round vote may actually be very near her ceiling, and roughly half of the Peruvian electorate does not want to return to Fujimorismo. And some of them are really, I would say, pretty fiercely opposed to that. Fujimori nunca más, they say. Fujimori never again. So I think Pedro Pablo Kuczynski, polls have shown him actually, some polls, edging her out in the second round. And he's now going to be looking to build an alliance to take him to June 5th. And some of that, I think, will inevitably involve him reaching out to the left.
Reporter Simeon Tagle in Lima. Thanks a lot, Simeon, for the update.
Thank you, Marco.
You're listening to The World. Believe it or not, there's a film about Adolf Hitler that has Germans laughing out loud. You can watch it, too. Netflix just released it globally over the weekend. It's called Look Who's Back. It's an adaptation of a best-selling satirical novel. And the basic premise is, what would happen if Hitler returned to Germany 70 years after his death and found himself in a multicultural country deep in the digital age? The World's Carol Hill sat down to watch the movie.
Okay, two things struck me immediately when I saw this film. One is, I laughed.
And the second, the fact that I laughed made me feel really uncomfortable. And then I wondered if it's okay for Germans, of all people, to make fun of Hitler. So I asked the director of Look Who's Back, David Vnent.
It's good and even healthy to laugh about him, but it's a big difference whether you laugh about him as a person or whether you would belittle his crimes or what he actually did, or if you laugh about the victims. That's a big difference.
Vnent believes Germans need to laugh about Hitler and not simply demonize him.
Because if he's such a monster, you're basically saying, well, it was his fault and nobody else's fault. But that's not the truth. I mean, it was just normal people who elected them, normal people who followed orders, and normal people who could have stopped him, and that didn't happen. So the responsibility and also the fault, also historical fault, is with the German people, with ordinary people.
The plot of Look Who's Back is simple, sort of. It's set in modern Germany, and Adolf Hitler wakes up, still in uniform. He's lying on the grass in Berlin, on the exact spot where his bunker was, the place he spent the final days of the Third Reich, and where he committed suicide with Eva Braun in 1945. But this being the digital age, someone sees him, videotapes him, and it goes viral. Eventually, some TV producers find out about him, and they put him on talk shows. The audience loves him. This Hitler is more laid back and less shouty than the original, but his fascist core comes through. If you just listen.
Ich bin hier der Führer, ja? Und zwar seit 9 Monaten bin ich hier der Führer. Und anständiger Regisseur hätte das in anderthalb Monaten in diesen Kasten reinbekommen.
But modern-day Germans miss the clues, and Hitler gets a huge following. Get it? But that's not it entirely. Director David Vnent went meta and mockumentary when he adapted Look Who's Back into a film. Before he started shooting the dramatic parts, he took Oliver Masucci, the actor playing Hitler, on the road and in character all over Germany and filmed his interactions with people of all types. Masucci says it was a disturbing experience.
And the first thing they did was taking selfies. I took about 25,000 selfies that time. And first they laughed and they asked, what am I doing there? Why am I dressing like Hitler? And then I always say, no, I am Hitler. I'm shooting a movie about Germany that the innocent guy from the countryside can say what he really thinks. And it's not critical. It's I'm a racist. And then people started to talk to me. This was really awful.
Masucci says people eventually talked to him as if he was Hitler. They told him they thought democracy wasn't working, that Germany needed another strong man, that refugees should be sent home and the unemployed put in labor camps. Director David Vnent says he was hoping people would interact with the Hitler character, but he was surprised by the depth of those interactions.
No matter where we went, there were always people who really kind of fell for him, basically. And that's kind of sad in a way. It was good for the film, but sad for our country, I guess.
I pressed Vnent on this. After all, Germans were talking to someone dressed up as Hitler and playing Hitler as a character. Can you really draw any conclusions from that?
Maybe in the beginning or so. But I mean, he talked to them and they forgot about the camera and so on. And they really took him seriously. And when he gave them his ideas, they really thought those ideas were great. And he immediately touched on things like immigration or politicians and whatever, and they were really open-minded, open-eared about that.
These real interactions with the fake Hitler are woven into the dramatic film. So you see real neo-Nazis taking selfies with Hitler. But you also see fictional scenes like this one, where a staffer at a Berlin TV station is trying to teach Hitler how to use a computer and a mouse.
Unter welchem Namen soll ich denn Ihre E-Mail eintragen?
Na, unter meinem natürlich, Adolf Hitler.
Sorry, wenn ich jetzt nochmal nachfrage, aber...
She asks him to pick a username. He says Adolf Hitler. She says the name's already taken.
Na, das ist doch super. Schmuel ist doch duft. Schmuel, schreibe ich das mit H?
Das war ein Scherz.
At one point, an elderly Jewish woman realizes this man dressed up as Hitler really is Hitler, but no one pays attention to her. And the only time Hitler gets in trouble in this contemporary satire is not for his fascist views, but when an online video turns up showing him shooting a dog that's annoying him. Actor Oliver Masucci says it's important that Germans can take a satirical approach to Hitler, but it doesn't mean they're off the hook.
As Germans, we can't get rid of him anyway. When I was traveling around the world and meet many people, I heard it so often, Heil Hitler, Heil Hitler. And now 70 years ago, lots of people think that they want to get rid of him, but we can't because he's still there in some parts of us, or people see him there.
Now, I have to admit, when I first heard about this German satirical film, I thought, Germans aren't exactly known for their sense of humor. I put that to director David Venant. It's a terrible stereotype, but many people outside of Germany think that Germans are humorless. Disabuse us of this stereotype.
I can't. It's absolutely true, unfortunately.
But there's absolutely nothing funny about the reason for that.
Before Hitler came to power, the Jews in Germany were, of course, a huge part of the entertainment industry. And Jewish humor has a long and strong tradition and so on. And because of the Holocaust, we still, up to today, you can feel that loss of humor and creativity because of the Third Reich, in a way.
I know. It's a tough thing to hear, but it's exactly that kind of raw nerve that this film is trying to touch. The film Look Who's Back is now available on Netflix. For The World, I'm Carol Hills.
We've got the trailer for Look Who's Back up on our website. And if you're hooked, we've also got a link to where you can watch the whole movie on Netflix. As you may have guessed, it's entirely in German, so you may need to turn on the subtitles. It's all over at PRI.org. Germans, as you just heard, can do irony, and they do it pretty well. And as proof that Look Who's Back isn't just an aberration, here's more irony, musical irony, from Hamburg's own Bacow Rhythm and Steel Band. First time, I bet, you've heard a steel pan cover of 50 Cent's P.I.M.P. New material there from Hamburg's Bacow Rhythm and Steel Band. That'll do it for us today from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.